as keen as he'd ever experienced. The boat wouldn't come. Not today. Not for a while. Maybe not ever. And that was just fine with him. That meant he could play his games. And if he played them patiently enough, carefully enough, he might be the only one left to greet a boat when, if it did show up. He turned his vaporous, test pattern face up to the new sun. It was warm and not unpleasant. It would be an unseasonably hot day. New life could grow in this kind of heat. He walked back to the fire to rejoin the others. Chapter 19. When the boys awoke, the cooler was gone. It contained all the food Scoutmaster Tim set aside, wieners and buns, a six-pack of Gatorade, a bag of trail mix, Hershey's Kisses, all they had left until the boat arrived. Max had placed it next to the fire the previous night. When they woke up, it was gone. "Where the hell is it?" Ephraim said. He stamped around the campsite, knuckling sleep crust out of his eyes. "I'm hungry, man." The others roused themselves slowly. Their sleep had been fitful, thanks to the ominous howls and sly scuttlings of wild creatures lurking beyond the fire's glow. Newt said, "The cooler's missing."
"No shit, Captain Obvious," Ephraim said. "Which one of you guys took it? Was it you, Newt, you lardo?"
Newton beheld Ephraim with bruised eyes.
"Eph, why would I..."
"Because you're a big fat ass," Ephraim stated simply.
"Newt slept next to me the whole night," Max said. He knew it was wise to calm his best friend down before he lost it, as Eve's mom would say. "If he tried to take the cooler, I'd have heard him." Shelley came round the side of the cabin.
"Where the hell were you?"
Ephraim said, the challenge clear.
"Had to take a piss."
"What happened to the cooler?"
Shelley set his flat-hanging face upon Ephraim's.
"Dunno, boss."
Ephraim balled his fists. He wanted to plant one between Shelley's cowish eyes, but he was distantly fearful that his fist would sink right into the placid emptiness of Shelley's face. It would be like sinking into a bowl of warm dough studded with busted light bulbs. Worst of all, he got the queasy feeling that Shelley wouldn't exactly mind it, and that his face would eat his fist, dissolve it somehow, like acid. Ephraim inhaled deeply, willing himself to stay calm. His mother said he had a temper just like his father's. The father who'd headed out to catch the afternoon steaks at Charlottetown Downs and never came home. The shithead who'd busted his own son's arm and didn't even remember. The father who was currently a guest of the province at the Sleepy Hollow Correctional Center following a string of convenience store thefts, one of which netted the princely sum of $5.02. He was also the man whose footsteps many figured that Ephraim would inevitably follow. "The apple never falls far from the tree," went the whispers around town. It didn't help that Ephraim looked almost exactly like his father. The same antifreeze green eyes and open-pored olive complexion. And, Ephraim knew, the same temper. One afternoon, he and his mother had come across a construction site, an open sewer with a nest of hoses running down into it. Workmen had set up a large reflective warning sign. The top left of the sign was crimped so that it read, "Anger, keep clear."
"You should heed that warning,"
his mother had said. And Ephraim tried to. But people were always pushing his buttons, which he had to admit were more like huge hair-trigger plungers. Whenever his emotions threatened to spill over, he'd follow his mother's suggestion to breathe deeply and count slowly backward from 10. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3.
"Wild animals must have dragged it off while we were sleeping," Kent said. "We should have hung it in a tree or something."
Kent looked nothing like last night's world beater. A dirty ring of sweat darkened his t-shirt collar, the same dark patches bloomed under his armpits. His eyes sat deep in his skull, the flesh around them knitted in fine wrinkles. It looked a little like the wattle on an old biddy's neck.
"Bullshit," said Ephraim. "How would we not have heard animals making off with it?"
"I was pretty zonked," Max said. Ephraim pointed at Newt.
"You figure the masked skunk made off with it too?"
Newton winced.
"I was wiped last night too. I mean, it could have..."
"Fuck, man, if one of you took it, just admit it,"
Ephraim said, his voice taking flight to an upper octave.
"What do you think I'm going to do, go crazy? Start laying you guys out?"
He raised his hands, all innocence.
"You couldn't have eaten it all, right? So we'll just say you've had your fill and leave it at that."
"Animals," Kent croaked.
White hot rage pounded at Ephraim's temples. His molars ground together so hard that he could hear them in his skull, thick plates of shale scraping against one another. He stalked away from the campfire in the direction of the cabin, but he took a wide berth around it, continuing on into the sparse woods behind. He pulled a battered old Sucrette's cough drop tin from his pocket. 3 lonely cigarettes jostled inside. He'd hoped to duck away with Max, sharing a smoke down by the shore while they stared at the stars. Max didn't smoke, but Eve planned to convince him to be his smoking buddy. Otherwise, it was just him, alone, launching off lung rockets, snacking on cancer sticks, which painted a pretty lame picture, actually. He poked a cigarette into his mouth, flicked his brass Zippo, and touched the flame to tobacco. He inhaled, coughing as the gray vapor rasped his throat. At first it felt like swallowing fiberglass insulation, the pink kind stacked in bricks at the hardware store, hissing the smoke between his teeth. He tried to blow smoke rings, puffing out his cheeks, but the wind rose out of the west and tore them apart. Birds called in a metallic ree, 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 a sound like a rusty axe drawn across a cinder block. The nicotine hit his system, nerve endings tingle. "Settle down," he chastised himself. "So what if one of those assholes ate the food? You'll be at your own kitchen table with a big plate of spaghetti in, like, what, 2 hours, right? Away from this island, away from the dead man." Which, truth be told, had freaked Ephraim out more than anything in his life. Seeing the man laid out stiff, with his limbs jutting at weirdo angles and his chest slicked in brown gunk, that had been the worst part, that he'd died streaked in filth. Ephraim had barely managed to tamp down the high-pitched wail that had threatened to spill over his lips. He'd never seen a dead person before. The closest he'd ever come to anything remotely like it was the time he'd been walking home from school and saw a hydro worker get blown off a power pole by a jolt of electricity. The guy had been 30 feet up in a cherry picker. A current surge must have ripped through the transformer. Ephraim remembered the guy's face and body lighting up like a 4th of July sparkler. The flash was so bright that it printed everything on Ephraim's eyes in negative for a minute afterward. The man rocketed out of the cherry picker as if there were dynamite in his boots. He hit a sapling on his way down. The limber little tree bent with his weight before snapping with a crisp green sound. By the time Ephraim ran over, the workman was up and walking a dazed circle. The electricity had melted the treads of his boots. The rubber pooled around his soles as if he'd stepped in black jelly. Ephraim found it painful to breathe. The dissipating electricity left a lingering acidic note. Smoke spindled out of the man's overalls right through the coarse orange weave of the fabric rising off his shoulders in vaporous wings.
"Ah, God, ah, God,"
the guy was saying over and over, mincing around in stiff stutter steps like a man walking barefoot over hot coals.
"Ah, God, ah, God, ah, God, ah, God."
The flesh over his skull had melted down his forehead. The electricity had somehow loosened his skin without actually splitting it. Gravity had carried the melted skin downward. It wadded up along the ridge of his brow like the folds of a crushed velvet curtain or the skin on top of unstirred gravy pushed to one side of the pot. His hair had come down with it.
His hairline now began in the middle of his forehead. The man didn't seem to realize this. He kept hopping around, saying, "Oh, God, oh, God." In the calm eye of terror, Ephraim became aware of the tiniest details, like how the hairs on the man's head were melted and charred, like the bristles of a hairbrush that had drawn too near an open flame, or how the skin on the man's head, sheerer and hairless and now stretched with horrifying tension over the dome of his skull, was threaded with flimsy blue veins like the veins on a newborn baby's skull. Ephraim had run to the truck and babbled into the CB radio. He was still babbling for help when the paramedics showed up. That was the closest Ephraim had ever come to death until last night. And the dead man here, who the hell was he, anyway, had been so much worse because he had been so much more final. The dead man couldn't get skin grafts and a hair weave like the workmen could. All that lay in wait for the dead man was a lonely hole in the dirt. And now Scoutmaster Tim was pretty sick too, maybe the same way the dead man had been. They'd locked him up in that stupid closet. Ephraim hadn't quite felt right about it. He got carried away, was all. And now Kent looked like he'd been attacked by vampire bats in the night. They'd sucked a gallon of blood out of him, and soon... He inhaled deeply, held it, let it go. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. "Are you angry, Eve?" came his mother's voice. "Or are you scared?" Ephraim realized that those emotions existed on two sides of a razor-thin line. One bled into the other so easily. Anger, keep out. Fear, keep out. "It's always good to have a little fear, son, especially at your age," he heard his mom say. "Fear keeps you honest. Fear keeps you safe." Ephraim stubbed the cigarette, dug a small hole in the earth. "A little grave for my coffin nail," he thought cheerlessly, and buried the butt. He headed back to the campfire, confused in his thoughts. From the sworn testimony of Nathan Erickson, given before the Federal Investigatory Board in connection with the events occurring on Falstaff Island, Prince Edward Island. Question. Dr. Erickson, please describe the discussion between Dr. Edgerton and yourself regarding the selection of a human test subject. Answer. I wouldn't really term it a discussion at all. Edgerton said he was doing it and I could come along for the ride if I wanted. Question. And you agreed? Answer. In for a penny? But I also thought maybe I could help things somehow, keep it under control. Question. You could have kept it under control by informing the police. Answer. I could have. Question. But you didn't. Why not? Answer. It's a tough thing to describe. Now that I'm away from it, the answers are so simple. Men like Edgerton are obsessives. Notions of right or wrong have this awful way of draining away to irrelevance with men like that. The only thing that matters to them are answers, progress, unlocking doors, and if you can't unlock them, you just kick at them until they give. I guess I was sucked up in it, too. Question. Tell me how Dr. Edgerton went about finding Tom Paget, the first human test subject. Answer. It wasn't so hard as you might think. It's amazing how many people are so down on their luck they'll take just about any offer that's flung at them. Edgerton went to bars, not the campus bars where the fresh-faced, rosy-futured kids drank. The scum pits on the edge of town. He trolled, is, I guess, the word, threw his bait in the water and waited for a bite. Question. He told Paget his plan? Answer. Not right off the bat. He did it in stages. I don't know the exact run of their conversation. You'd have to ask Edgerton. Question. Dr. Edgerton is not an easy man to get a straight answer out of. Answer. Edgerton just brought Paget back one night. Guy smelled like he'd been marinating in a tub of old grouse. Edgerton explained it all calmly and evenly. He'd take the injection and sit in the room. We'd monitor him. If things got out of hand, we'd call a doctor. Never mind the fact that no doctor on earth had a cure for what Edgerton would stick him with.
Edgerton handed him a nice fat envelope. I don't know how much cash was in there. I guess it was enough.
Chapter 20. The cooler was discovered 200 yards down toward the shore. There was no physical evidence to indicate it had been dragged, no zigzag lines through the soft dirt or trampled weeds. This suggested it had been picked up and carried to its present spot. It lay overturned in a patch of purple-pink shrubs. But the crude way that the food had been shredded did suggest an animal. The hot dog packages had been torn open. Raw rags of the granular pink meat lay scattered about the cooler, a lit upon by listless late October flies. M&Ms were strewn around like multicolored jewels. Ephraim kicked dirt over a half-chewed hot dog. His jaw was set at a sideways angle, his eyes hooded. Fuck it. Boat'll be here soon. The boys walked down to the shore. They hadn't packed their bags. None of them wanted to go inside the cabin, though none of them spoke those words. The air was crisp, with the soft undernote of peppermint. The face of Newt's Timex Iron Man read 8:23. The boat was scheduled to arrive at 8:30. Kent slumped on a boulder carpeted with moss that resembled the fuzz on a tennis ball. When he was sure nobody was watching, he pinched some moss and stuffed it into his mouth. He didn't know why he'd do such a thing. It shamed and disgusted him. He was just so damn hungry. Newton sidled up. Cautiously, he said, "You okay, Kay?" "I'm fine." "You look a little green." Newton gave him a chummy smile and pointed to the water. "Like me when I get seasick. The rest of my family have great sea legs, but not me. When the boat gets swaying, I just toss my cookies, lose my lunch every time." "Newt, screw off." Kent gave Newton a look more pleading than threatening. "Okay, please?" He turned away and caught Shelley gawping at him. That same vapid look as always. Was it, though? Kent had been sure the others were asleep when he'd woken last night. The growl of his stomach had drawn him out of a deep slumber, an aching burr like a chainsaw revving endlessly. He'd sat up with his hands reflexively clawing his belly. His eyes had darted to the cooler. Next, he'd glanced at the other boys, scrutinizing them carefully. They were asleep, Newton snoring loud as a leaf blower. His gaze had been drawn helplessly to the cooler. The hunger was like nothing he'd ever known, beyond an ache. More like an insistence, a summoning. There was a big, dark pit inside of him, something that had started out as a pinprick hole but had rapidly grown into a vortex, the equivalent of a violent tornado, but instead of the random objects that a twister pulls into its funnel, trees and mailboxes and lawnmowers, the one inside of him was sucking at his own insides, his liver and his kidneys and lungs and stomach, with the incredible pressure of industrial machinery. Kent had been terrified that if he let it go on much longer, the hole would suck clean through him, out of him. He'd stood silently and crept to the cooler. His heart beat a staccato hi-hat behind his ribcage. His bladder was so tight he thought he might piss himself. Kent had forced himself to exhale softly. Otherwise, his breath would escape in shrill peeps like a baby bird calling for food. And what did baby birds eat? Worms. Their mothers chewed them up in their flinty beaks and regurgitated them. Worms just like the one that still lay on the cabin floor next to the dead man. Except not that big. And not so maggot white. It would take a million birds to eat a worm that huge. Kent's hands had crawled over the cooler's lid. The pebbled plastic reminded him of summer picnics. An ice-carpeted cooler with the brown necks of Coke bottles poking up. Watermelon sliced 2 inches thick. He'd bite through its pink flesh and spit the black seeds. Seeds that looked like little blood-swollen ticks, now that he thought about it. His hands flirted over wieners and buns and teardrops of chocolate wrapped in silver foil. Surely one couldn't hurt? It was his, anyway. 1/5 of this food was earmarked for him, so what if Kent wanted to eat his share in the middle of the night?
He'd plucked a Hershey's Kiss from the bag with trembling fingers. A runner of drool stretched into a glimmering ribbon in the firelight. He'd unwrapped the chocolate quickly and popped it into his mouth, chewing and swallowing. Before his mind could catch up to the mechanical movements of his fingers, the bag was empty. He'd lost track of things. His fingers and lips were streaked with brown chocolate. Brown. Kent's gorge rose with quick revulsion. Brown like the muck pooling out of the dead man's stomach. With swift, silent movements, he carried the cooler down near the shore. Things went hazy from there. Kent could only recall brief glints and flashes, tearing and rending, shoveling and swallowing. He may have wept while doing it. At some point, he'd glanced up and saw Shelley watching. Shelley, who should have been sleeping. Shelley, whose face had gone wolfish in the moonlight.
"Go on," he'd mouthed to Kent. "Keep eating. Enjoy it."
When Kent came back to himself, the cooler was empty. The persistent internal suck had ebbed to a muffled quaver in his gut. It was more than he'd eaten in his entire life. Guilt settled into his bones like lead. He pictured his father hovering over the scene with an accusatory eye. "You don't get it, Daddy," he'd wanted to say. "You don't understand what I'm going through."
"I understand weakness, son. Prisons are full of weak-willed men."
Afterward, Kent had stepped into the ocean to clean his hands and face. The cold water pinkened his fingers. Even at that hour, the mainland was a flurry of light and motion. He cupped water in his hands and walked back to the cooler, wiping his chocolatey fingerprints off the handles. On the way back to the fire, he'd found Shelley lingering beneath the leaves of a weeping willow. Kent curled a fist and settled it under Shelley's chin.
"Say anything and I'll kick the shit out of you," he whispered.
"If you say so." Kent took a step back. Something in Shelley's placid expression nearly made his knees buckle.
"You know what, Kent?" Shelley said. "Your breath stinks like shit. Like cotton candy that someone took a big piss on. Can't you smell it?"
Kent could smell it. The treacly sweet stink with its ammoniac undertone nearly made him gag.
"I mean it, Shell. Keep your lip zipped."
Kent plodded back to the fire and struggled into his sleeping bag. But by morning, despite his devouring the cooler's entire contents, the hunger pangs had already returned. Newton glanced at his Timex again. 9:02. Stanley Waters' skiff should have puttered up to the wharf a half hour ago. It was not like Mr. Waters to be late. Before his retirement, he'd been the logistics coordinator at the local FedEx depot. The time of day was practically imprinted in his blood. Waters' favorite parlor trick was to look at his bare wrist when you asked him what time it was. Waters never wore a watch, and give it to you to the very minute. Freaky. He might be a minute or two off nowadays, but still, for him to be a half hour late, that was a rare occurrence indeed.
"You think something happened?" Newton said. "Mr. Waters is, what, 70?
"Do you think we could swim back?" Ephraim said. Newton scoffed.
"Are you nuts? With these currents? They run the Atlantic Ironman triathlon off Baker Beach."
He pointed in the general direction of North Point. "I went with my mom once to watch it. Guys were staggering out of the ocean. Their teeth were bashing together so hard I could hear it. Most of them puked. They were so exhausted. And those were athletes, grown-ups. And it was only 1,000 meters. From here to shore, it's 3 miles.
"There are sharks, too," said Shelley.
Their heads swiveled. Shelley's vulpine face was pointed toward the slate-gray water, his expression unreadable.
"Oh, bullshit," said Ephraim.
Shelley's scarecrow shoulders joggled up and down.
"Whatever. My uncle's seen plenty of sharks. He said one time a couple of oystermen caught a great white down by Campbellton. It swum into Kasumpic Bay after a storm. He says when the oysterman slid its belly open, 2 full wine bottles slid out onto the dock."
Shelley's uncle was a lobsterman, so it could be true. Ephraim made a fist and slugged his thigh.
"Could we make a raft or something?"
He pointed at Oliver McGanty's boat. "Or try to get the motor working on that?
What do you think, Max?
Why wouldn't we just chill out? Max said. He's only a half an hour late.
Almost 45 minutes now, Newton said.
It's probably nothing, said Max. Maybe he's constipated.
This earned a laugh from the others. Ephraim said, Old Man Waters is a total tight ass.
Thunderheads advanced. The boys watched the sky and rapped. Thunder rolled across the water and echoed back on itself, a sound that was somehow feathery and alive. The clouds shaded purple to jet black and then whitely incandescent, creased with lightning, billowing up like huge lungs inflating themselves. They spread across the water like a determined battalion. Rain washed down from the leaden clouds to tint the air beneath them a misty gray.
Maybe Old Man Waters knew a storm was coming, said Max. Maybe that's why he hasn't shown up.
Newton said, Why not just come early then? He knew what time to come. Why leave us out here with the big storm coming through?
We don't know it's a big storm, Max said uncertainly.
Soon they spotted the silvery shroud rolling across the water, which itself had taken on a brooding hue. It stretched over the ocean in a menacing canopy, pushing back the blue sky and blotting out the sun. The water bloomed deep red.
Shit, it's bad, Kent said thickly. We have to take cover.
They picked their way up the beach toward the cabin. Newton cast a panicky glance over his shoulder. The silvery pall was advancing at a terrific pace. Its contours had settled into a definite shape. A diaphanous funnel connected the water's surface to the corpulent black thunderclouds above. It rocked side to side like a hula dancer's hips. A cyclone. Newton recalled that one of those had touched down in Abbotsford a few years ago. It tore through the salt box shacks lining the shorefront cliffs, smashing them to matchsticks. It picked up million-dollar yachts owned by rich American cottagers and flung them about like a child tossing his toys during a playroom tantrum.
We've got to get inside, he shouted over the banshee wind, or underground, fast!
By the time they reached the cabin, the shaker shingles were slapping against the roof, a brittle wreck, wreck, like the clatter of dry bones. As one, they hesitated at the door. The dead man was in there. Scoutmaster Tim was locked in the closet. It was like revisiting the scene of a murder, one they'd all sworn in a pact to never talk about. Lightning daggered through a bank of rolling purple clouds and forked sharply into the ocean, the water lit with a mushrooming sheen as if a tiny atom bomb had gone off below the surface. Newton said,
We have to get inside. It's going to hit us any minute.
We need to take cover, but not in there, said Kent.
His face was bleach white except for the jaundiced flushes painting his cheekbones.
I don't want to see that man again.
Ephraim jeered. You wanted to see him bad enough last night, didn't you?
Scoutmaster's in there too, said Newton.
Kent set his body in front of the door. A trivial gesture, like having a scarecrow guard a bank vault. The wind rose to a breathless whistle that ripped around the hard angles of the cabin, making a ululating noise like a bowstring drawn across a musical saw.
They're sick, Kent said simply.
Sick, said Newton. Kent, one of them is dead.
Him, them, Tim. He's sick. The whole place is sick.
How about this, Kent? How about you're sick?
It was Shelley who spoke. The boys almost missed it. The wind tore the words out of his mouth and carried them away over the whipsaw treetops.
Newton said, What? Who's sick?
Isn't it obvious?
Shelley said, louder now.
Kent. He's sick as a dog. Last night I saw him.
Shut up!
Kent almost sobbed.
You shut your dirty mouth, Shell!
Last night, Shelley said, enunciating each word with utmost care. I caught Kent eating the food. He stole the cooler and took it down to the water. By the time I got there, he'd eaten it.
Shelley
was opening his mouth to say something more when Kent strode forward and dealt him an open-handed slap to the face.
You shut your lying fucking mouth. I'll kill you, you crazy little fuck.
Shelley just stood there. A trickle of blood ran from his split lip like heavy sap from a tapped maple tree. Did he even notice or care? The empty vaults of his eyes filled with vaporous white, reflecting the lightning that flashed over the bluffs. They became the glass eyes of a toy clown. "He did it," Shelley said softly. He didn't have to speak very loud anymore. The boys were attuned to his every word. "Yes, he did. Ate all our food. He couldn't help himself, could you, Kent? That's why I didn't say anything at first. I felt sorry for you, Kent. You're sick. You've got the worms." Kent sagged against the door. The effort it had taken to slap Shelley seemed to drain his meager power reserves. "We're not going in," he said haltingly. "Listen, Kent," Ephraim spoke with cold menace. A brick-hued flush was draining down his cheeks to pinken his neck. "You ate our food. Fine, whatever, it's been done, but I'm not standing out here waiting to get crisped by lightning. So I'll tell you what, take a quick count of the teeth in your mouth, then get ready to kiss about half of them goodbye, because if you don't get out of my way in about 2 seconds, you're going to be picking your pearly whites off the ground." Without waiting for an answer, Ephraim laid his shoulder into Kent's chest. Kent folded like a lawn chair. Ephraim barreled through into the cabin. The sickening sweetness hammered him in the face. The air inside a decayed beehive could smell much the same. Wind screamed through the gaps in the walls, the sound of 1,000 tea kettles hitting the boiling point. A swath of shingles tore off the roof to reveal the angry sky above, bruised darkness lit with shutter flashes of lightning. The wind curled in through the new aperture to swirl scraps of bloody gauze around the cabin like gruesome snowflakes.
"We have to get to the cellar," Newton said. "What about Scoutmaster?" Max shouted back.
They all turned to Kent, who had just dragged himself up off the floor. Lightning lit the sky and seethed through every crack and slit in the cabin.
"He's sick," Kent said. Ephraim said, "You're sick too." "I'm not!" Kent held out his hands. They did not make for compelling evidence of his claim. "I'm not fucking sick!"
"Max," Ephraim said, "is Kent sick or not?"
"I think maybe so," said Max, not because he wanted it to be so, but because there was no other answer for what he was seeing. "I'm sorry, Kent." "What a fucking shock!" Kent snarled. "The Bobbsey twins agree!"
The wind hit a momentary lull. In that dead calm, the boys heard Tim's voice calling them from the closet.
"I am sick."
Kent pointed at the door. An expression of smug elation was plastered on the strained canvas of his face.
"You see? You see now?"
Max knelt at the closet and tore the strip of duct tape off. Who the hell had put it there? He started yanking the tea towel stoppered under the door, then stopped abruptly. What if something squiggled out from under the door? The Scoutmaster's fingers even, gone thin and witchy like long pointed wires.
"There's a big storm coming," he said to the door, to the Scoutmaster. "It's already here."
"I can hear it." Tim's voice was weird. "What you should do is get some candles and blankets and head down to the cellar."
"What about you?"
"I think I'll stay right here, Max."
The hopelessness in his voice sent a volley of cold nails into Max's chest.
"Why?"
"You know why, Max. Are any of the other boys looking bad?"
"Yeah, I think Kent is." "I'm not sick," Kent screeched pitifully.
"You shut your mouth or I'll shut it for you," Ephraim said with cold contempt. The wind dropped to a brief lull. Tim's voice could be heard clearly.
"You have to be careful," he said, sounding immensely tired. "Whatever this is, it's catching. I don't know how, but it can be passed around, round and round. I'm so hungry, Max."
Thunder crashed overhead like massive 2x4s being thwacked together. The hair at the nape of the boy's neck stood at attention. A string of blood trailed under the closet door.
The ventricles of Max's heart ran with ice at the sight.
"You're bleeding," he whispered.
"Am I?"
Tim did not sound surprised or alarmed.
"I don't know where it could be coming from. I don't feel it at all. Now, go on, Max. Get down to the cellar. Go. Hurry."
Evidence log, case 518C, piece A-17, personal effects. Lab journal of Dr. Clive Edgerton, original audio recording, pre-transcription. Recovered from Site A, 220 Makepeace Road, Summerside, Prince Edward Island, by Officer Brian Skelly, badge 908. Test subject 13, Alpha Series. Chimpanzee, Marshall Bioservices, breeding batch RD489. Age, 3 years, 7 months. Female. Subject's pre-test weight, 105 pounds. Date, 9/22. Observing researcher, Dr. Clive Edgerton. 9 o'clock. I introduce the modified hydatid, genetic recombination Y8.9-0, via injection. Subject is alert and energetic, enjoying the use of its large enclosure with swing bar, reflective steel mirror, and splash pool. Subject is evidencing no overt signs of distress or pain. 10 o'clock. Subject state is unchanged. 11 o'clock. Subject state is unchanged. 12 o'clock. Subject state is unchanged. 1 o'clock. Subject state is unchanged. 1:54. Subject displaying signs of agitation, pacing its enclosure. It issues a series of vocalizations, shrill, dog-like yips. 2:13. Pacing continues. Vocalizations climb to a high and possibly pain-stricken pitch before softening. Subject is scratching its posterior aggressively, blood observed in small quantities. 3:09. Subject has consumed all foodstuffs placed in its enclosure. Approximately 5 pounds peeled and diced fruit, 1 pound dry mealworms, 5 pounds root vegetables, equivalent to 10% of subject's total body mass consumed in less than 40 minutes, 2:29 to 3:07. Subject failed to masticate food fully. Subject choked on fibrous tubers. Subject regurgitated said tubers. Shortly thereafter, subject consumed them again. 4 o'clock. Subject continues to scratch its posterior aggressively. More blood. Half a pint lost. Possible risk of anal fissure. 5 o'clock. Scratching has largely stopped. Prominent indentations under the ribs indicate rapid weight loss, although at perhaps a slightly slower rate than that registered in both rodent and feline test subjects. Weight loss still far too rapid to have any practical applications. 5:23. Visible folds of skin now gird the subject's pelvic brim, eyes sunken into skull, tissue degradation evident. Subject's demeanor placid and seemingly unconcerned. Hydatid has narcotizing effect. Post-edit note, see H. diminuta, transfection case study. 5:45. A large hydatid has extruded from the subject's anus, approximately 7 inches long. Significant tissue damage, swelling, and redness evidenced at extrusion site. Possible anal prolapse. Subject appears to be in no evident physical pain. Hydatid now approximately 1 foot long as of recording. 2.5 feet. 5:50. Subject paces enclosure. Movement sluggish and hesitant. The extruded worm, now 5 feet long, is trailing from subject's anus. Hydatid is thicker toward mid-body, diameter of a medium-gauge electrical cord. 5:52. Hydatid has fully extruded from subject, approximately 10 feet in length. It lies in a cochlear coil on the bare cement, subject seemingly unaware it has passed the worm. Eyes vacant and glazed, bumping into walls, visibly disoriented. 6:12. A bloody froth emits from subject's mouth, thick, creamy lather resembling milk foam. Subject evacuated froth with surprising force, hard enough that a copious quantity of blood simultaneously ejected from subject's nose. Post-test update, Investigation of Froth showed it to be teeming with dwarf hydatids. Subject is seemingly unaware of trauma. 6:30. Definite prolapse of anus. Severely hemorrhaged fist-like section of lower colon, plainly visible. Dark purple in color. Subject exhibiting no evident signs of distress. 7 o'clock. Subject lies down heavily on nest of hay and sleeps. 8 o'clock. Subject continues to sleep. Rapid aspiration of lungs. 9 o'clock. Subject continues to sleep. Post-test update. Upon consulting microphone rig to pick up ambient sound inside the enclosure, a definite squirming sound could be heard between 9:13 and 9:16. Hypothesis, sounds emanating from within, subject. 10:10. Subject wakes suddenly, eyes quite wide. The visible white portions are networked with burst blood vessels. Subject is in deeply agitated state, clawing at face and body. Subject is gibbering uncontrollably. 10:12. Subject calm again, hangs listlessly from play swing. 10:14. Subject sits in play pool, splashes water upon self apathetically. Water tinted red with blood from bodily wounds. Subject appears to be developing skin surface lesions, swellings noted on chest and arms and legs. 10:16. Subject pulling off hanks of fur. Subject staring at said hanks in a stunned and remote manner. 10:17. Subject is ingesting own fur. Subject is tearing off fur from arms and stomach and neck. Subject is ingesting more fur. There is blood. Quite a lot of blood. 10:42. Subject steps out of pool, moving with great difficulty. Ribs very prominent now. Outline of subject's skull visible beneath thin skin. Much fur has been forcibly removed from body and face. 10:43. Subject staring into steel mirror. Subject appears to be examining itself. Subject is pawing the mirror gently. 10:45. Subject attacks mirror, pounding it with great force. Subject leaves bloody prints on the steel. The subject is screeching and screeching and smashing fists into the mirror as if wishing to shatter it, shatter the reflection. 10:46. Subject moves away from mirror. Subject lies on concrete of enclosure. Subject emits low groaning sounds, also hissing sounds. 11 o'clock. Dr. Edgerton exits observation booth. Dr. Nathan Erickson undertakes observational role. 11:15. Subject is... Jesus Christ. Subject is not a subject anymore. I mean, holy God, is she? How could she be? Subject is more bone than anything. Subject. Jesus, you poor thing. You poor fucking thing. Clive, you bastard. This is... Oh, Jesus. She's trying to move. Subject. She's trying to crawl over to something. I don't know what. What the hell is that? Subject is, oh, Christ, oh, this can't. Subject clearly has a prolapsed anus. This is where the worm, I can now identify the coiled shape on the floor as a worm, where the worm must have exited her body. The subject is making her way toward the worm. The worm is long and white and greasy. The subject's body and face are covered in lesions. They look like very large and terrible bee stings. Some of the size of golf balls. The subject's mouth is opening and closing on nothing. Nothing. She's bitten through her tongue. The subject is hissing. I do not believe she's making this noise herself. I believe the worms are making this noise somehow. The subject has made her way to the evacuated worm. The subject is toying with the worm, flicking at it with a finger. The subject, oh dear God, don't do that. Oh, the subject is eating the worm. The subject is shoving the worm into her mouth, force feeding herself the worm. She's eaten the worm. She's eaten it all. It's gone. The subject is mewling,
drowning kitten sounds. She's mewling and lying still. Her lesions are pulsating. I think I can see. Oh, fuck no. Jesus. Jesus Christ. Clive!
11:23. Dr. Erickson exits examination booth. Dr. Edgerton re-enters. 11:24. Lesions appear to be breaking open all over subject's body. Hydatids must have escaped the intestinal walls. They entered seams between pockets of the subject's muscle strata. They are presently exiting from fissures eaten through the subject's swollen skin. They are smaller than the worm that exited the subject's anus, thread-like specimens. 11:28. Several large-ish specimens are breaking through the flesh of the subject's cheeks. 11:32. Subject drags itself to a standing position. Subject is reeling around, clawing at self. Subject is tearing off swatches of infected flesh. Stark bone visible at subject's left elbow. Subject seems largely unaware of bodily devastation. 11:36. Subject is tearing a long strip of flesh off forehead. Eyes nearly white. Cataracts? Ocular occlusion? Blood running freely. Subject making no sounds to indicate pain or suffering. Methodically peeling flesh, several white threads can be seen wriggling in mangled tissue of forehead. 11:40. Two large hydatids break through the lens sacs of the subject's eyes. Worms infested the corneal vaults. 3-inch hydatids, quite thick, protrude from the subject's eye sockets, wriggling rather animatedly. 11:42. Subject blindly consuming own stripped flesh. 11:47. Subject immobile. Worms braiding into each other on the exterior of subject's body, engaging in procreation. 11:50. Subject exhales heavily. Chest does not rise again. 11:55. Subject assumed deceased. Worms continue to exhibit movement, although not so energetic. 12:15. Exterior worm movement has ceased. Subject's lower abdomen continues to pulse faintly. 12:33. Large quantity of worms evacuated from subject via anus and mouth. 12:40. All organisms deceased. Biodecontamination and disposal processes initiated. Test concludes. Test duration, 15 hours, 40 minutes. Subject's post-test weight, 44.3 pounds. Total weight loss, 60.7 pounds. Chapter 21. Before the boys entered the cellar, a fight broke out. Ephraim ransacked the cabin cupboards for candles and a pack of matches. He picked nimbly around the dead man, whose limbs had stiffened at tragic angles and whose body now shimmered with fruit flies. Newton dashed down to the fire pit and grabbed their sleeping bags. He cast a fearful glance at the ocean. The water was in complete turmoil. With the wind whipping about, Newton's feet didn't feel entirely moored to the earth anymore. He raced around the side of the cabin to meet the others. Ephraim had thrown the cellar doors open, the plywood trembling in the wind. Snapped spider webs flew like the flimsiest lace over the yawning entryway. The fermented smell of the earth rose up. The sky had gone the color of a blood blister. Only a weak sickle of light shone into the cellar. The first few dusty wooden steps were visible, but the remainder of the staircase was overtaken in pooling shadows. Ephraim pointed at Kent. "Sorry, man, you aren't coming down with us." Kent's face somersaulted from shock to rage to speechless terror at the prospect of being left alone outside. "You can't," he offered his hands in a wordless plea. "You can't just..." Ephraim crossed his arms. "You did it to the Scoutmaster." Max saw the strange electricity running behind Ephraim's face. Cruel voltages quivered his skin. "That was different," Kent said feebly. "I don't think so. I think it was smart." Ephraim's hands spanked together in a polite golf clap. "Very smart." "We can't just leave him out here, Eve." Ephraim wheeled on Newton. "You want to get sick next? Want to be sneaking off in the middle of the night to eat everyone's food?"
I'm sorry, Kent whispered.
Ephraim cupped a hand to his ear. What's that? Can't hear you.
I'm sorry. Tears brimmed in the cups of Kent's eyelids. Just let me come down with you, please. Don't leave me out here.
No can do, Ephraim said coldly.
What are we going to do, Eph?
Max said, gesturing to the storm set to make landfall. Just leave him?
He can go back inside the cabin, said Eph. It doesn't matter now.
Which was when Kent tried to bowl past Ephraim into the cellar. Yesterday that confrontation would have been a coin flip. Now it was pitifully one-sided. Ephraim pushed Kent, an instinctual move, his face wrenched with quick revulsion as he shoved Kent aside as one might a squirming sack of beetles. Kent went sprawling. Newton said,
Eph, come on.
Ephraim's lips curled back. Stay out of this, you fat shit. Kent crawled up and came again. For an instant it looked as though Ephraim would step aside. This tormented expression came over him, stuck between confrontation and flight. But his rage took over. He punched Kent in the belly. His fist sunk into Kent's gut in some terrifying way. It was as if Kent's body shaped itself around Ephraim's fist, welcoming it. Kent's breath came out in a gust. Stay down, Ephraim told him. Instead, Kent dragged himself up. He looked like some bloodless creature risen from his grave. His face had the pallid sheen of a dengue fever victim. The other boys ranged into a silent ring around Ephraim and Kent, the same ring that seems to form organically in schoolyards whenever a fight's brewing. Rain now pelted down to soak them through to their skivvies. Ephraim struck out impulsively at Kent. If his mother had seen him, she'd have noticed the quick, reckless anger in his eyes, so much like his father. Ephraim's fists zipped out and back rapidly, as if repelled by Kent's yellowed flesh. In short order, he'd raised a goose egg on Kent's forehead and bloodied his nose and smacked him squarely in the left eye, a wound that would blacken nicely before long. Kent held his arms out, fingers squeezing and opening convulsively. His skin tore like crepe paper, stretched too tight over the flinty outcroppings of his face. Blood leaked out of his wounds, only to be rinsed away by the heavy rain. Kent kept trying to speak as Ephraim's fists peppered him. I'm sorry, he said penitently, his voice unheard amid the peals of thunder.
I'm sorry, sorry, sorry.
Ephraim's fist sheared off Kent's jaw. Blood leapt through the electrified air. Ephraim's knuckles had split open. It went on forever, and then it stopped. Ephraim's eyes remained wild, his nostrils dilated.
You can stay out here with him, he told Newton. Your choice, but he's not coming down.
The hardest-hearted part of the boys realized that Kent had earned this. If you call the tune, you also have to pay the piper when he begs his due.
We can't just leave him, Eph.
Eph rounded on Newton. We can, and we're gonna. Or I'm gonna. And Max, too. And Shelley, I guess. Shelley was already halfway down the cellar stairs. The other boys remained in the pelting rain, lightning spearing over the trees. Ephraim turned to Max.
Come on, man. Let's go.
Max fell in behind Ephraim. Then he checked up. Dark clouds massed overhead, throwing them into a sudden light. Lightning lit the twitching contours of their faces.
Eve, man, Max said, can't we at least find someplace safer for him?
The two boys stood face to face, shirts rain stuck to their chests, heartbeats shivering their skin. Something passed between them, a subtle split, an inelegant falling away. Maybe it was necessary, maybe not. But it happened. Both boys felt it. Eve said,
Do you have any idea how stupid you are, Max?
Don't lock the door, Max said, holding Ephraim's gaze. We're coming back. Come on, Kent. Three boys skirted the cabin's edge. The wind blew with such gale force that it elicited shrieks from everything it touched. The logs shrieked as it lashed at their unflexing angles. The trees shrieked as gusts
threatened to uproot them from the ground. Even the grass shrieked, a thin and razor-fine whistle, as the wind danced between every blade. Rain needled down so hard that they felt as though their faces and arms would be sliced open, like walking through a storm of paper cuts. Kent stumbled, arms outflung. Max reached impulsively. Newton's hand manacled his wrist. Newton shook his head and mouthed, "You can't touch him." Kent dragged himself out of the muddy stew, his boots slipping. They looked too big all of a sudden, his feet swimming in them, and followed Newton to the woodpile. It was rung by stacked cinder blocks and edged by trees. The wind wasn't quite so bad.
"Stay here!"
Newton had to holler to make himself heard. Kent knelt, too tired to argue. The boys folded the woodpile tarp and settled it over Kent's shivering shoulders. Earwigs and millipedes and wood lice and deer ticks squirmed from the dead logs, startled by the storm. Crawling and twitching through the mud, they skittered up the tarp. Max reached out to brush them away, revolted at the thought of touching them, but even more revolted at the possibility they'd alight on Kent's skin and hair. Newt grabbed his hand again. Kent didn't seem to mind. His eyes darted, charting the course of those milling bugs. Newton said,
"We'll come get you soon."
Kent's head swiveled, a mechanical motion, like a toy abandoned in the rain. Lightning creased the sky and seemed to penetrate his flesh, igniting his bones in skeletal relief. His lips split in a grin that sent goose flesh up the nape of Max's neck. An earwig squirmed round the cup of Kent's ear, tracked across his face, and hung like a squirming fat raindrop from the boy's lower lip. "Kent," Max breathed, horror twining up his spine like a weed. "There's a..." Kent's tongue snaked between his teeth, curled lovingly around the earwig, and drew it into his mouth. His eyes never left theirs.
Chapter 22. When Ephraim was 8, his mother took him to visit the mausoleum where his grandmother was kept. He remembered feeling slightly curious beforehand. Back then, Ephraim still held a healthy curiosity about death. He remembered the thin, acrid smell that had attended their entrance into the granite rostrum, the sterilized smell of death. It wasn't the fly-blown battlefield reek with its sweetness that was kissing cousin to a truly good smell, barbecued pork, maybe, a sensual similarity that made it all the more sickening. This was sanitized and tolerable, an ammoniac mothball smell overlying subtle decay. Ephraim caught that same pungent smell as he'd crept down the cabin cellar steps. His heart made a giddy leap. What had died down here? Ephraim had watched as Max and Newton guided Kent behind the cabin, wind snapping their clothes against their frames like flags flapping on a pole. A thin needle of regret had lanced through his heart. He'd argued with Max about abandoning Kent, and they never argued. Rage had pounded at Ephraim's temple as his neck flushed with heat. No fists had been swung, but it had been a fight all the same. That bothered and confused him. Ephraim possessed a keen sense of fairness. He'd inherited that from his father. The only phrase he could ever recall him saying was, "You pay what you owe," and his dad was paying now, in prison. Kent had earned his ills, hadn't he? He needed to pay what he owed. But where did that leave Ephraim now? In a cellar with Shelley Longpre, the last alignment he'd ever seek. He pulled the doors shut, latching them from the inside. The wind and rain roared and bashed the cabin above. The sway-backed steps groaned under his feet. Long, straggly tendrils trailed lightly across Ephraim's face. They felt like the dangling, unnaturally long limbs of a daddy long-legged spider. He lit one of the candles he'd scavenged. It illuminated Shelley's face. His skin seemed to radiate a light all its own, a greasy luminescence as if glowworms were stitched under it. Shadows, made misshapen and monstrous by the wavering candlelight, scurried along the cellar walls. The root systems of trees and plants dangled down from the roof.
Ephraim walked the perimeter. Empty. Barren. A musty boat tarp was heaped in one corner. The heap seemed to expand and contract in the fitful light.
Sit down, Eve.
Shelley sat cross-legged on the dirt. With his long limbs folded, knees and elbows kinked, he looked vaguely insectile, like a potato bug curled into a protective ball, only its gray exoskeleton showing. Or one of those cockroaches that would scuttle up the drains during island storms, the ones that hissed when you